On January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger lifted off at the Kennedy Space Center. The launch was broadcast live, with many classrooms watching, because Christa McAuliffe was among the crew as the first member of the Teacher in Space project. 73 seconds into the flight, the Challenger disintegrated in the cold skies over the Atlantic, instantly killing all aboard. What caused the crash? To answer that question, President Ronald Reagan set up the Rogers Commission, named after its chair, former Secretary of State William P. Rogers. Also on the commission were Charles Yeager, the first person to break the sound barrier, Neil Armstrong, the first person to walk on the moon, Sally Ride, the first American woman in space, and, with reluctance, the physicist Richard Feynman. The most famous moment in the commission's work occurred during a televised hearing. The subject was the temperature at which the flight had been launched and the O-rings that sealed a joint on the right solid rocket booster. A gas leak at that point had been seen in footage just before the disaster. But Morton Thiokol, the company that manufactured the O-rings, insisted that their product couldn't have been the problem. In the course of the televised hearing, Feynman offered an experiment. He used a flexible O-ring of the same material, clamped in a C-clamp, and submerged in the ice water on the table in front of him. When he took the O-ring out and removed the C-clamp, it did not resume its previous shape. It wasn't resilient. For at least a few seconds, long enough to cause a major failure, the material cramped in the cold. In an appendix to the final Rogers Commission report, Feynman wrote, "For a successful technology, reality must take precedence over public relations, for nature cannot be fooled." Feynman's was a beautiful experiment. Beautiful, first and foremost, for its simplicity. Media was at a fever pitch. Within an hour, 85% of the American public had seen rebroadcasts or heard of the disaster. The reputation not only of major companies, but of NASA and the United States space program were at stake. What caused the crash? Look at what happened to that O-ring in a glass of ice water. In this lecture, I want to talk about the structure of experiments, putting questions to the test. Feynman's is just one of the beautiful experiments I want to explore. An understanding of scientific experimentation and of its limits is an important part of the contemporary philosopher's toolkit. An understanding of experimentation is important both in backing your own claims and in evaluating claims of others. In order to establish an empirical claim, the gold standard is a well-designed experiment. The key, however, is that qualifier, well-designed. Many of the claims that come our way, claims in the media regarding medical safety or efficacy, for example, are presented as having scientific experiment behind them. In order to really evaluate these claims, we need to be able to evaluate the experimental work behind them. Are those experiments well designed? Look again at the structure of Feynman's experiment. The question is, what caused the disaster? The commission had studied footage of the event repeatedly, and that footage seemed to show a gas blow-by just before the spacecraft broke apart. Could that have been the problem? And what caused that? They were looking for a chain of causal events. A causes B, B causes C, and C causes the disaster. It became clear that a blow-by of pressurized hot gas and flame could have hit an adjacent external tank, leading to the structural failure. But Morton Thiokol insisted that the O-rings couldn't have been what allowed the blow-by. What Feynman's ice water showed was that indeed they could have, that Morton Thiokol was wrong. I want you to note three things about that experiment: the risk of the experiment, its power, and its limitations. First of all, the risk. Karl Popper insisted that every good scientific hypothesis takes a risk of being proven wrong. Feynman took that risk. If the ring had come out of the water and sprung instantly back into shape, his O-ring hypothesis would have been discredited, right there on television. But of course, it didn't come out that way, hence the power of the experiment. It no longer mattered who said that the O-rings couldn't have been the problem. Nature can't be fooled, as Feynman said, and nature said they could have. But note also the limitations of the experiment. All that was shown is that the O-rings could have failed. Perhaps it shows that they could be expected to fail under the temperatures of the flight, 15 degrees colder than any previous launch, incidentally. But the experiment didn't show that something else might not also have been a factor, even a major factor. The experiment only addressed one link in the causal story that the Rogers Commission finally settled on, the link from the O-rings to blow-by. The rest of the story about released gases and flame hot enough to impact the exterior tank, about that leading to the breakup of the spacecraft, all that part of the story had to come from somewhere else. Feynman's experiment, like all experiments, functioned only against a broader theoretical background, within a wider theoretical context. All experimentation is about an if-then. What any experiment really shows is if this, then that. Feynman's experiment shows that if you put a C-clamped O-ring of this material in ice water, then its resilience fails. If X, then Y. It seems to me that humans must have always tested things by asking, what happens if you do this? If you hit a tasty bone with a large rock? Or extend a spear with a throwing extension? In that sense, it seems that humans must always have performed experiments. Animals seem to test things in much the same way. They feign an attack to see if the enemy retreats. What'll he do if I do this? They nose prey to see if it'll move again. Scientific experimentation is just a more formal extension of that kind of if-then testing applied to general claims at the level of scientific theories. The question, what was the first scientific experiment, is thus bound to invite controversy. Around 200 BC, Archimedes submerged himself in his bath and saw the displacement of water, then applied that principle to other cases. Does that count as an experiment? Around 50 AD, Hero of Alexandria developed some amazing hydraulic devices, which must have required extensive if-then testing. Does that count as experiment? Credit for the beginnings of scientific experimentation is often given to the Islamic school, the school of Jabir ibn Hayyan, around 800 AD. Known for elaborate alchemical equipment and insistence on practical experience, or Alhazen, who around 1000 AD published a work on optics with a number of experimental demonstrations. I think if-then testing is quite natural to both people and animals. Scientific experimentation is just a formalization in a context of large-scale theory. If so, and as long as formalization and large-scale theory remain vague, the answer to what was the first scientific experiment will be vague as well. The concept of controlled experiment leaves a clear historical record. We envisage the functioning of the universe as a complicated pattern of causal chains. We want to know what that causal pattern is. What causes what? We want to know whether X's cause Y's. In order to establish that X causes Y, we have to establish more than just if X, then Y. In order to establish that X causes Y, we really have to establish two if-thens. We need to know that if X, then Y, but we also need to know that if not X, then not Y. We need to know that X is what makes the difference as to whether or not Y happens. The core of any test of causality is therefore a double test. we need to have two cases side by side, one with and one without X. That's the whole idea of a control and of controlled experiment. Here's another beautiful experiment as an example. The theory of spontaneous generation had the authority of Aristotle, who claimed that some animals developed not from kindred stock, but from putrefying matter. It was the decaying meat itself that was thought to generate maggots, for example, which then develop into flies. Imagine yourself in an Italian city in the 1600s. You can imagine the crowded streets, the tiny butcher shops, and the clouds of flies around those butcher shops. Put a piece of raw meat out and it'll soon have maggots. Aha! Spontaneous generation. There's an if-then for you. Francesco Redi had a suspicion that Aristotle was wrong, that all animals developed from kindred stock, and that it was flies rather than meat that generated maggots. In 1687, he published the results of a controlled experiment as a demonstration. He put fresh meat in four jars, exposed to flies in the open air. That's the if X, then Y part. If flies, then maggots. But he also put fresh meat in four other jars, covered with cloth so as to keep the flies away. That's the if not X, then not Y part. That's the control. Maggots developed in the uncovered jars, but not in the covered ones. It wasn't the meat, but the flies that bred maggots. The double if-thens of controlled experiments form the basis of all our causal knowledge. In constructing an experiment, you have to make sure that you have a clear conception of both the experimental condition and the control. In evaluating an experiment, you need to ask, what's the control? But take a minute to think about what that demands. What we want is two cases that are exactly alike except for the presence of X. If in one of those cases we observe Y and in the other we don't, and the two cases are otherwise exactly alike, in that setup it must be X that made the difference. The double if-thens form the basis of all our causal knowledge. The demand that our two conditions be identical except for X is the major source of all experimental difficulty. The problem is that there's always the possibility of hidden differences between our two conditions. Redi's covered and uncovered jars were supposed to differ only in the presence and absence of flies, but of course they didn't. Air circulation would be different with and without a cloth over the top. Temperature was probably affected. Maybe the type of cloth they used suppressed spontaneous generation. Asking for just one difference between two cases may be asking for the impossible. Any two cases will differ in hundreds of ways. One jar will be north of another, or east, or closer to the window, or the one I put the meat in first. We think we know that those are differences that don't make a difference. But that's just the point. All experiment tests things we don't know against a background of other things we think we do know. The conditions of controlled experiment are no different. The difficulties of getting two cases otherwise identical, except for some factor X, becomes even more pressing when we're dealing with complex experimental subjects. People, for example. We want to know whether a given treatment prevents scurvy or cures cancer. We need two groups of people, those who are given the treatment and those who are not, but we want the treatment or the lack of it to be the only difference. We want the groups to be identical in all other respects. Good luck. People are complicated. Groups of people are still more complicated. You will never get two groups of people identical except for factor X. So what do we do? Here's another beautiful experiment. Scurvy had long been a problem for men at sea. It was a problem in 1747 when James Lynn served as a surgeon on Her Majesty's ship Salisbury. There were a number of proposed cures for scurvy, and he tested them with a controlled experiment. The cures, a quart of cider every day, 25 drops of sulfuric acid in water 3 times a day, or 1/2 pint of seawater every day, a lump of garlic, mustard, and horseradish, 2 spoonfuls of vinegar 3 times a day, 2 oranges and 1 lemon every day. Lin selected 12 men from the ship, all suffering from scurvy, and as similar as he could choose them, he said. He then divided the men randomly into 6 pairs, giving each pair one of the cures, and he watched what happened. The important point is that Lin chose men as similar as he could, and that he randomized them into pairs. As it turned out, all the men showed some improvement, but the 2 given oranges and lemons recovered dramatically. One was back to duty after 6 days. The other helped care for the rest. Lin's is an early case of what we now call a randomized controlled trial. When it comes to experimental subjects as complicated and as various as people, we can never be confident that the factor X we are testing for is the only difference at issue. Indeed, we know that it won't be. There will always be other differences between people and between groups of people. What we do instead is to assign our groups randomly, with large enough groups, with tests repeated often enough, with strong enough results on one side and not the other, it becomes increasingly implausible that there is some hidden factor other than X that's producing the result. In constructing a solid experiment with complex subjects like people, you want to make sure you have a random enough selection procedure within a large enough group that your results are unlikely to have happened just by chance. You want to know precisely those same things in evaluating experimental claims from other sources, claims from the media, for example. Unfortunately, those crucial details often don't fit within a soundbite. In order to evaluate those claims, you often have to do a little more research as to how the research was conducted. The philosophical understanding of scientific procedure developed hand in hand with its application. I'll give you 3 high points: the work of Francis Bacon, John Stuart Mill, and R.A. Fisher. In 1620, about 60 years before Rady's experiments refuting Aristotle, Francis Bacon published his Novum Organum, that means the new organon. The title is a direct reference to Aristotle's logic in the Organon. Francis Bacon intended his work to be a new organon, a new philosopher's toolkit. The core of that new organon is an emphasis on if-then experimentation. Bacon contrasts experimentation with other ways, what he takes to be erroneous or fallacious ways of forming beliefs. He pits empirical experiment against appeal to authority, against vague theorizing, against appeals to experience without experimental manipulation. In 1843, the philosopher John Stuart Mill published his System of Logic, intended to offer a logic appropriate to scientific investigation. Mill gave a series of methods, all of which focus on the kind of double if-then test we've emphasized for deciding whether X causes Y. Mill's method of difference is precisely that double test. If X is the only difference between 2 cases, with Y as a result in one and not in the other, we have an indication that X causes Y. Mill's other methods complement that structure. Here's his method of agreement. If 2 cases are alike only in X, and Y occurs in both, we again have evidence that X and Y are causally linked. Our evidence is even stronger, of course, if we have both of these. That's Mill's joint method of agreement and difference. Y appears whenever you have X and disappears when you don't. We've talked throughout as if X and Y were just on or off, there or not. Mill also generalizes that to a case in which things might be more or less X or Y. That's the method of concomitant variation. If Y varies as X varies, we again have indication of a causal link. Beyond Mill, the most important improvements in our understanding of scientific procedure have been in the development of statistical measures for randomized testing. The philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce was important in early development, but much of current practice traces back to the English biologist R.A. Fisher. It's been said that Fisher almost single-handedly created the foundations for modern statistical science. Fisher's work was motivated by a beautiful experiment of his own, known as the Lady Tasting Tea example. The topic's trivial. Fisher's experimental design and analysis are not. The British take their tea with milk. At a summer tea party, a lady claimed the tea tasted differently if one first put in the milk and then added the tea, or first put in the tea and then added the milk. Preposterous, said the scientifically minded men around her. Fisher put the question to the test with a randomized control experiment. 4 cups were prepared with the milk first. 4 cups were prepared with the milk second. The lady was fully informed of the procedure and was then given the cups in a random order. Her task, to pick the 4 that were prepared with the milk first. Fisher formalized the case in terms of 2 hypotheses. He actually thought the lady wouldn't be able to detect any difference. He called that the null hypothesis. The alternative hypothesis was that she could tell the difference. If she picked the 4 cups correctly, what confidence should we put in that alternative hypothesis? Fisher's calculation of what we now call statistical significance was based on the probability that she would have made the right choice by chance alone. That's essentially what all controlled, randomized experimentation looks like today, from political polling to medical experimentation. Oh, and the result? She picked the 4 cups correctly. We can say with a high degree of confidence that there really is a difference in how tea tastes, depending on whether you put in the milk first or second. A difference, at least, in how it tastes to a lady. Complex experimental subjects, like people, make randomized testing a necessity. There are also other ways in which people make things complicated. These call for other constraints in experimental design. Suppose you want to know whether Coke or Pepsi tastes better. You do a straightforward test. You buy a can of Coke and a can of Pepsi and offer people a sample from each. Which tastes better? You can see the problem with that experiment. Coke drinkers may be loyal to their Coke. The same for Pepsi people. Because they can see where each sample is coming from, you may not be getting a pure taste test. In order to make that experiment better, you'd like your test tasters to be unable to see the cola cans. You want them to be blind. Now we're talking about a blinded experiment. There are cases, however, that call for an even more scrupulous experimental design. We've been talking about experiments that involve human subjects. All of those experiments also involve human experimenters. When a researcher strongly believes in a hypothesis, there's always the chance that he or she will influence the results by giving unconscious clues to the experimental subjects. In order to guard against that, double-blind experiments are used. In a double-blind experiment, neither the investigator nor the subject knows until later whether the randomized case they are dealing with is from the if-X group or the if-not-X group. In evaluating experimental evidence, then, you want to know, what was the control? If complex subjects like people are involved, you want to know, how was randomness assured? What's the probability of that result just by chance? For some questions, you may want to know, was this experiment blinded? Or was it double-blinded? Is there a scientific method? In a sense, there surely is. The principles of experimental design we've been talking about are all parts of the toolkit of empirical investigation. The scientific method taught to many a junior high school student includes aspects of investigation emphasized since Francis Bacon. Define a question. Formulate an explicit hypothesis. Design a test with measurable outcome. Perform the test and analyze the results. But the notion of a scientific method that can be followed robotically, like a recipe for truth, is a myth. Alhazen said it in his experimental work on optics. Finding the truth is difficult, and the road to it is rough. William Woole's Philosophy of the Inductive Sciences, published just before John Stuart Mill's System of Logic, emphasized that science requires not mere method, but invention, sagacity, genius. Scientific research also often requires luck. It's been estimated that half of all scientific discoveries have been stumbled on. Often the process starts with what appears to be a problem with the scientific apparatus, a bug in the program. When that bug doesn't go away, it starts to dawn on the investigator that the unexpected result may not be an error, but precisely that, an unexpected result. Aha! Here's a beautiful example. On the morning of September 28, 1928, Alexander Fleming came back from vacation to his lab in the basement of St. Mary's Hospital in London. As he tells the story, he noticed a petri dish containing the bacterium Staphylococcus. He'd left it open by mistake, and it was now contaminated by a blue-green mold. Around the mold was a halo in the bacteria. Fleming concluded that the mold was releasing a substance that inhibited bacterial growth. He had discovered antibiotics. After a few months of calling the active substance mold juice, he decided to name it after the blue-green penicillium mold. He called it penicillin. And as he often had to remind people, "I didn't invent penicillin, nature did that. I only discovered it by accident." Much of scientific discovery is a matter not of method, but of invention, sagacity, genius, and luck. All of those can go together. Louis Pasteur is credited with the saying that chance favors the prepared mind. Philosophers of science have long distinguished between a context of discovery and a context of justification. Scientific discovery can be chancy. There's no recipe, no algorithm, no scientific method of discovery. Once a discovery is made, however, the process of demonstrating the fact to others can follow a very specific method, the method of repeatable experiment. Once Fleming had his initial hunch, however fortuitous, it was by controlled experiment that he demonstrated its truth. I've tried to emphasize aspects of experimental design that are important both in presenting and in evaluating experimental evidence. But there are limitations. Unfortunately, there are cases in which the information we need in order to evaluate experimental evidence is somehow hidden or unavailable. Experimental results can be faked, and sometimes have been, both in the fringes of pseudoscience and in core areas of medical testing. Experimental results can be selectively chosen to support the favored case. It's called cherry picking. There are perennial worries that drug companies choose to report those experiments that make their products look good and choose not to report those that don't. What you really need to know is the results of all the relevant experiments. The file drawer problem. Not every experimental result is submitted for publication, and not every result submitted for publication is accepted. When one surveys the literature searching for whether most experiments support or fail to support a particular effect, one may be surveying a misrepresentative sampling of the tests that have actually been run. The tests that show a less dramatic or a less popular result may be buried unseen in someone's file drawer. There's another limitation to experimentation that I've tried to emphasize throughout. Experiment is never pure. It's always in context. All effective experimentation tests one belief against a background of other beliefs. For the moment, at least, those other beliefs are simply assumed. One of the earliest cases cited in the history of experimentation is Eratosthenes' calculation of the circumference of the Earth, sometime around 225 BC. The basic observation was this: on June 21st, the summer solstice, in the Egyptian town of Syene, the sun appeared directly overhead. Looking down a well, a man's head would block the sun's reflection. Back in Alexandria, Eratosthenes knew that on that day, the elevation of the sun was 1/50th of a circle off from being directly overhead, a little over 7 degrees. He knew that Syene was south of Alexandria, and thanks to the royal surveyors, he knew the distance between the two towns. Assuming the Earth to be a sphere, and the sun to be so far away that its rays could be thought of as essentially parallel, Eratosthenes was able to use those two facts with a little mathematics to conclude that the circumference of the Earth was a little over 25,000 miles, very close to our contemporary estimate. But note the assumptions at issue. If the Earth were not a sphere, the calculation wouldn't hold. The experiment wouldn't show that what it was taken to show. If the Sun were not so far away that its rays could be treated as parallel, the calculation wouldn't hold. The Huainanzi is a Chinese text from approximately the same date. It also notes that vertical sticks at different points north and south cast shadows of different length on the same day. From that fact, and the assumption that the Earth is flat, the text concludes that the vertical sticks with shorter shadows are directly under the Sun, those with longer shadows are farther away, the Sun's rays hit those at an angle. From the length of those shadows, the Huainanzi concludes we should be able to calculate the height of the Sun. Because no experimental result is established independently of a set of background assumptions, what every experiment really establishes is an alternative. Either the claimed result holds, or one or more of our background assumptions is wrong. In the next lecture, I want to return to a theme that we've touched on at various points: thinking rationally in a social context.